in Washington, Oliver Zandona, Robert Haynes, and others in the K Street office met continuously with American officials working on Iraq economic and oil policy. "Your job is to promote U.S. companies," was the essence of ExxonMobil's message, recalled a State Department official who heard it regularly. "Do your best to create a level playing field. If you put us up against any state-run company from Russia or China, on a level playing field, we'll win." Beyond that, the corporation wanted the Bush administration to stay as far away from the oil sector as possible, the official recalled, because otherwise the United States would be perceived as meddling and would be a PR problem. Then, too, fierce Iraqi nationalism after the American invasion ensured that no elected government in Baghdad could blithely trade away ownership of Iraqi oil to foreign companies, even if doing so might enrich the government's coffers. Iraqis ratified a new constitution that declared that the country's oil belonged solely to the Iraqi people. Shah Rustani's clean games visit to Washington in 2006 signaled, however, that the Iraqi oil ministry had gradually come to recognize it could not restore Iraqi oil production to acceptable levels on its own. After the talks with Energy Secretary Bodman and the oil company lobbyists, Shah Rustani soon negotiated what he called technical service agreements with ExxonMobil and other companies. Under its deal, ExxonMobil would formally study and evaluate how to raise the rate of oil production in particular Iraqi fields. The corporation used its access to develop and present to Iraqi officials an ambitious plan for ExxonMobil's re-entry into the country, a $100 billion transformative program under which ExxonMobil would lead huge, staged investments in Iraq's oil and gas fields. These upstream investments would be integrated with similarly ambitious downstream projects, refineries, petrochemical complexes, and the like. In essence, ExxonMobil proposed a strategic position in the Iraqi oil industry comparable to its dominant position in Qatar. The scale of the plan was bold, and also politically unrealistic. International oil investments in Iraq brought to the surface all of the ills and paralysis of Iraq's post-invasion politics. ExxonMobil's PowerPoint slides, with photographs of shiny infrastructure, arrows showing the benefits of integration, and lots of big dollar numbers, could not change that. Whatever deals emerged, Shah Rustani's oil ministry wanted to pay the companies in oil, not cash, so as to avoid the complications of negotiating in Baghdad with a separate political fiefdom at the Ministry of Finance. It wasn't clear, however, that companies that received oil from the deals could sell it freely, as they had under authority of the now-defunct Coalition Provisional Authority. Kuwait's government had won a war reparations award against Iraq's government to pay for losses caused by Saddam Hussein's 1990 invasion. The enforcement of this award meant that cash from the sale of Iraqi oil normally ran through United Nations-authorized accounts in New York, where a portion was garnered to pay Kuwait. It was not clear whether ExxonMobil's sales of Iraqi oil might be subject to the same garnishing. Zandona and other ExxonMobil lobbyists repeatedly pressed the Bush administration to sort out the issue at the United Nations and with Kuwait and Iraq so that the corporation could lift Iraqi crude without any legal ambiguity. If Iraq's greatest sensitivity was sovereignty, ExxonMobil's imperative was reserve replacement, the need to be able to continually book oil reserves in a manner approved by the Securities and Exchange Commission. If Iraq's oil opening were to make a difference to the corporation, deals had to be structured so that ExxonMobil could book reserves. Initially, after the war began, ExxonMobil and other major American oil companies pushed the Bush administration to persuade Iraq's government to adopt production-sharing agreements or other contract terms that would allow private oil companies to book Iraqi reserves for Wall Street. An early study of Iraq's oil industry, carried out for the Coalition Provisional Authority by the consulting firm Bearing Point Incorporated, suggested to Iraqi oil officials the benefits of production-sharing deals. The study cited nations such as Azerbaijan as examples. In Baghdad and Washington, Bush administration officials told their Iraqi counterparts that contract matters were up to them, said a State Department official involved. But they also made clear to the Iraqis, as the official put it, "You lack capital, you lack technology, and your workforce needs to be re-educated. you have to offer some incentives to allow the companies to come in. Of course, the whole issue is booked reserves. What hope ExxonMobil had to own a share of Iraq's oil rested on the long, costly efforts of the Bush administration to remake Iraq's oil policies after the invasion. From the beginning, executives from the American oil industry, almost all of them from Texas, had led the Bush administration's efforts. They volunteered for the mission, uncompensated. Philip Carroll, the former Shell USA executive and friend of George H.W. Bush, who had been recruited before the 2003 invasion to advise Iraqi and American officials about Iraq's oil sector, had, for example, resisted the Bush administration's most ardent free market ideologists, particularly those who advocated outright privatization of Iraq's state-owned oil companies. When analysts at the Conservative Heritage Foundation called the privatization of Iraq's oil a no-brainer, Carroll quipped, "It's a no-brainer. Only someone with no brains would think of that." After Carroll left the Coalition Provisional Authority, a succession of other American oil industry veterans arrived in Baghdad one after another to serve as senior advisors on oil restoration and policy. Rob McKee, who had run upstream operations at Conoco, and Mike Stenson, another former Conoco executive. They slept in trailers in the Green Zone, worked in dusty sections of the Republican Palace, endured nightly mortar rounds, and braved ambushes when they rolled in armored sport utility vehicles across town to the oil ministry for meetings. Robert Morgan, a British oil industry veteran, died in one such insurgent ambush. Diaries the American oilmen kept during their deployments as advisors depict a dizzying atmosphere in which a few patriotic, talented Iraqi oil technocrats struggled in an environment of political dysfunction, rumors of corruption, and constant violence. On the American side, McKee and Stenson, who considered themselves conservative patriots called to public duty, and who carried firearms outside the Green Zone to protect themselves, found their idealism sapped by petty bureaucratic infighting in Washington and reams of federal government paperwork.